So I had four general categories of question. Sort of conserve my battery here, and you can just talk on any of these subjects until you feel like you gotta go or whatever.
Right. Okay.
The first thing is the EFF work that's going on there, and in particular, what you see as the big fights over the next 5 years ago and handicap the prospects for the good guys and the bad guys. So that's number one. Number two is, where is publishing going? Mm-hmm. And how do I make $1 million with my little self-published books, mm-hmm. or at least not lose too much money? Number three is, what's the most interesting stuff to write about now? Obviously, you know what's most interesting because that's what you write about, what's most interesting to you. But, you know, and four is Clarion. What's going on with Clarion? And
okay,
so Gary does my, he's my webmaster, and we're putting up the Clarion banner on Web Machine.
Oh, nice. Well done, you guys. Well, yeah. So probably the easiest one to answer is what's most interesting to write about in terms of fiction, or even nonfiction.
Yeah.
For me, I love writing about stuff that I enjoy because it makes it tax deductible.
Okay.
So write about Disney World, get tax deductible trips to Disney World. Write about gadgets, all your gadgets are tax deductible. So that's kind of my glib but surprisingly sincere answer about what's the most fun stuff to write about. It's definitely the stuff that you you spend your discretionary income on and would like to have a tax write off for.
Right.
The other ones, well, so I think that I'm always reluctant to say this is the biggest fight or this is the most important thing, but I can tell you about some important things that EFF is working on. The international dimension to me is the most important right now.
All
right. The U.S. is creating trade obligations for itself abroad that require it to not change the laws it has at home. For example, when the Digital Millennium Copyright Reform Act, the DMCRA, Rick Boucher, I think that's what it stands for, Digital Consumer Media Reform Act, something like that, DCMRA, Rick Boucher's bill, on reforming the anti-circumvention stuff in the DMCA, so it would be legal to break software locks if what you were trying to do was legal, right? Right now, it's actually, you'd think that this wouldn't be the case, but if you have the right to access something, but someone's put a lock on it, it's illegal to unlock it.
Yeah.
Right. Breaking the lock is illegal, no matter what's on the other side or whether it belongs to you.
Right.
So, the idea was to have this modest reform that said you could break the locks off of things that belong to you.
Right.
Right. To do lawful things.
Right.
That's a pretty modest reform agenda, and it would make it legal for people to make tools that accomplish that and to provide services and so on. Because obviously, most of us aren't equipped to break locks.
Right.
Right. So when Boucher introduced this bill, the U.S. Trade Representative was in Singapore and Chile negotiating trade agreements in which the U.S. essentially promised a trading partner that it wouldn't introduce this bill.
Right.
So here you have like an appointed bureaucrat from the administrative branch subverting what's going on with elective representatives in Congress, right? So I think the international dimension can't be neglected. I think that there are other really important areas to watch. One thing that's got me scared witless is there's a proposal for what's called a new intermediary liability standard at WIPO. People who provide access to information on the internet are intermediaries, right? They don't they're not the ones who make the information. They intermediate the process of retrieving it. So ISPs, libraries, web hosts, DSL providers, telcos, hotels, schools, they're all intermediaries. Offices, you know, your office network makes your employer into an intermediary. So in 1996, the ISPs entered into a devil's bargain where they said, we think intermediaries should be held liable for what their customers do, but we should be able to get out of that liability if we embrace a code of conduct whereby if someone tells us that something that we're hosting is infringing, that we take it down immediately and then only put it back up if the other person disputes it and so on. This is called notice and takedown. It's not obvious that we actually need that, right? I mean, if I walked into your shop, if I walked into your restaurant and sat down at a back table with a t-shirt on that had Mickey Mouse giving the finger, I'm violating Disney's trademark, but it's not the restaurant's job to police that, right? So, someone walks into your ISP and puts a file on the server that violates Disney's copyright, why should the ISP have to have any liability for what they do? Why shouldn't that be a private matter between the person who's actually committing the infringement, and the person
Or the telephone company for two mafiosi having a conversation.
Right. So but you know, it seemed like a good deal at the time, because taking something down really just means moving the files, right? And then putting it back up just means moving them back again. In practice, it's actually pretty uncommon for ISPs to ever put it back up. They all have these really abusive terms of service that let them just terminate your account if they get a complaint.
Right.
And it's simpler to do that than to actually even have a lawyer review the situation.
Right.
So, like, this allows, like, the Church of Scientology to say whenever anyone criticizes them, they can call up the ISP and say, well, these people aren't criticizing us, they're violating our copyrights. We demand that you take this material down. Or, you know, Diebold, when a whistleblower memo showed that they committed felonious acts of voter fraud.
Right.
You know, they were able, electoral fraud with their voting machines. They didn't actually dispute the claim. They just said, well, those memos that were internal.
Property,
and they were works made for hire, commissioned, you know, by us, but written by our employees. And, you know, anyone who hosts these memos that show that, you know, the American electoral process is being subverted by corporate greed is a copyright infringer, and we should be able to get around all the due process stuff. So the problem, such as it is, with notice and takedown from a rights holder's perspective is that it's completely ineffective at peer-to-peer. Right. You know, I call you up and I say, someone connected to your internet, to your DSLAM, to your central office, is hosting a file that infringes my copyrights. What do? You call them up and say, like, so I want you to go to your desktop and find the My Shared Files folder. Mouse down. No, not that folder. Yeah, okay. Now delete that file. What if they say, well, I'm not hosting anything, right? There's someone within 300 feet of my Wi-Fi access point that's hosting this, right?
Right, yeah.
So how do you expeditiously take down material that's in a peer-to-peer universe? Well, the proposal is for something called notice and termination. And this is a proposal at WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, to create a new regime for intermediary liability where ISPs who are told that a customer was infringing copyrights by material they were hosting on their own computers would be responsible for terminating that customer's internet access.
Wow.
Well, if you've got, it's one thing to move a file and move it back again. It's another thing to deprovision and reprovision a phone line, right, a DSL line. That can take a year to 3 years for an ISP to recoup. So if an ISP got what they get now with takedown notices, where sometimes they get thousands of automated takedown notices, they got thousands of automated termination notices, it would put them out of business, right? By the time they reconnected all those customers, they would have lost so much money on the teardown and setup of that circuit that they'd be out of business. They'd be out on their asses. So, what the rights holder groups anticipate is that ISPs will begin to aggressively police what their users do to reduce the likelihood that they'll get one of these takedown notices, and that the obvious means by which you'd accomplish that is by saying things like rate throttling.
Right.
Deep protocol, deep packet inspection to limit which protocols you're using, port filtering, basically things like essentially intrusion detection systems. So what you do is you'd say anyone whose traffic falls outside of the norm is disconnected,
right?
Or is throttled down to nothing. Kids in universities get this all the time, right? You try to torrent a public domain movie from the Internet Archive, and you find that your university's entire bandwidth available to people who want to use BitTorrent across the outside network limited to 5K per second.
Right.
This is the case even at elite engineering schools like Olin College, where I just gave a talk, which is otherwise an example of brilliant instruction, fantastic, especially their library and information resource stuff. But their IT department throttles the entire university's outbound BitTorrent bandwidth to 5K per second. Well, what if you want to download the outcome of a WIPO meeting or of an engineering seminar at another school
or this interview,
right? I mean, this is basically saying, well, in order to control the way our bandwidth is used, and in order to limit some potential liability, we're willing to punish an infinite number of innocent people to get at some guilty people. And I think that's a disaster. That turns the internet into AOL 1.0,
right?
Where if you want to make something new on the internet, if you're Tim Berners-Lee and you want to invent the web, the thing that you need to do is convince everyone who runs a firewall or router on the web that your protocol won't harm their business model, right?
Right.
As opposed to today, where if you want to invent Skype, you just invent Skype.
Right.
Right? And you tell other people about Skype, and they use Skype too, and then you get Skype, right? Yeah. Podcasting, well, you know, podcasting is possible because of BitTorrent, because of MP3, because of large file transfers, because of RSS, all these application layer protocols and file formats that can be used just as readily to infringe as to right. promote legitimate discourse. And, you know, if what we're saying is, well, anything that can be used to infringe is presumptively prohibited, right. it's the end of the internet as we know it. So I think those are some really important issues. That's not even touching on other really important issues like FISA and national security letter warrants being served on ISPs, new data retention and snoop powers for cops and for people who claim to be assisting cops, contractors, and so on, and all of that stuff. I mean, you know, without even getting into that, without getting into trusted computing and the danger that poses, I think there's a lot here. Handicapping whether or not we're going to win, well, you know, I think that this stuff is starting to wake up some of the sleeping giants in the public interest
right.
and sleeping giants in the corporate boardrooms. You know, Verizon and Sprint are now turning up at like WIPO in Geneva, sending representatives to WIPO in Geneva to say, this is crazy, right? You know, it's about time, you know, it's about time that the $6 trillion telecoms industry told the pipsqueak 1% of their turnover $60 billion entertainment industry that they're not going to bend, you know, that
right.
they're not going
right.
to let them run their show. But, you know, and so we're getting that. And then the other thing is, you know, the internet matters to more people than it ever
right,
has before.
Right.
And every day it matters to more people than it did the day before.
Right.
And those people are starting to have a burgeoning consciousness of the politics of information
right.
freedom. You know, when Napster was built, it had a failing, which is it wasn't compensating artists when it shipped out. Of course, neither did jukeboxes when they started, or records, or the radio, or cable, or VCRs, right? But it had this very salutary effect, which is that it took a world where 80% of the music was available at no, you know, wasn't available at any cost as a good in commerce, and put it all available on the internet for essentially for free. No one had to spend any money to digitize that. It was digitized at the edge and indexed and put into put back into kind of the public discourse, right?
Yep.
So, but when we shut down Napster, the 52 million American Napster users, it's 2 million more than elected the president that year, right? They didn't say, well, wait a second, right? You just burned down the largest library of human creativity ever assembled.
Yep.
They said, oh, you know, there goes our free ride.
Right.
And they went off and joined Kazaa, right?
Right.
Well,
and they got their machines infected.
Yeah,
right.
Well, and what we really need is pitchforks and torches, right? What
right.
we really need is the next time someone says, well, we're gonna burn down the library, we're going to eliminate, you know, unlimited, unfettered communication, all these kinds
right.
of technological things. What we really need is pitchforks and torches. We need lawmakers to be put on notice by their voters that if you break the dominant form of entertainment in America, we won't vote for you anymore.
Not only
right?
entertainment, but...
Well, but
yeah,
but historically, yeah. that's been the third rail. Historically, when the sheet music people wanted to ban the record player, right,
right.
the Congress was unwilling to ban the thing that was entertaining the majority of their voters, right?
Right?
When the record people wanted to ban the radio, Congress was unwilling to ban the radio. When the radio people, you know, the broadcasters wanted to ban cable, Congress was unwilling to ban cable. And when the cable people wanted to ban the VCR, Congress was unwilling to ban the VCR.
That was a tight one, though.
Well, no, yeah. it was pretty, Congress did the very gutsy move of doing nothing.
Right.
right, and letting the court sort it out, because you read the decision in the VCR fight, the Betamax decision from 1984, and the courts pretty much say Congress has a wide open door to change this all they want. We're interpreting the law as Congress wrote it. Congress, you know, if the motion picture studios want to block the VCR, there's nothing in the Constitution that would stop Congress from doing it. You know, it was basically an invitation. You know, they volleyed it over the net, and Congress just sort of looked the other way and whistled away and walked away whistling with their hands in their pockets, right?
Right.
I mean... That, you know, after 8 years of courtroom shenanigans and congressional hearings, for them to just walk away and do nothing was actually a pretty substantial undertaking.
Right.
You know,
right.
It was tight in the Supreme Court, but it wasn't. But it was. I think it was never an issue about whether or not Congress was going to make a law banning the VCR.
Yep.
You know, reason recoils from the idea that you shouldn't be able to record a television show and watch it later.
Right.
Right? And it's really easy to explain to constituents that, you know, Congressman Chubby Bottom in office there just destroyed, you know, the device in your living room.
So that's easy to understand.